Hi, welcome. I'm Olga Visa, director of the Hirshhorn, and it is my pleasure to welcome you to our Meet the Artist talk with Hiroshi Sugimoto. And it's really a privilege to welcome back such a distinguished artist to the Hirshhorn. We first showed Hiroshi's photographs in 1999 in our Regarding Beauty exhibition. And for that exhibition, he created another stunning installation, but a quite different installation of his seascapes. And it was really one of the highlights and culminating galleries in that exhibition. And since then, I'm pleased to say that we've been able to show a deeper commitment to Hiroshi's art by bringing a number of photographs into the collection. Organizing this comprehensive survey of his work, which just opened last evening here at the museum on the second floor. And the survey covers a period of 30 years, and I think really questions, as all of Hiroshi's work so beautifully does, the nature of truth and representation in photography. Hiroshi's exhibition will be on view through May 14th, and although the galleries are not open this evening after the talk, we invite you to come and come often and really take in this really remarkable and breathtaking, I think breathtaking installation. The exhibition is co-organized by the Hirshhorn Museum and the Mori Art Museum in Tokyo, and I want to acknowledge David Elliott, the director of the Mori Art Museum, who's here with us tonight, as well as Carrie Brower, the Hirshhorn's Director of Art and Programs and Chief Curator, who collaborated as co-curators on this exhibition, and it's been a wonderful partnership between our museums. I also want to acknowledge curatorial staffs on our respective museums. Mami Takaoka, Senior Curator at the Mori Art Museum, is also here with us tonight, and the Hirshhorn's Kristen Heilman, who worked very closely with David and with Carrie. Tonight, the format for the program is we're going to invite Hiroshi on the stage together with Carrie Brower, and they're going to have a dialogue and discussion about Hiroshi's work and his creative process. Before I introduce them and invite them to come up on the stage, I want to acknowledge the supporters of our exhibition. The exhibition is made possible by the Helenia Trust, which is trust established in memory of Joseph Hirshhorn, the Hirshhorn Board of Trustees, and also members of our annual circle, our annual donors who make so many of our programs here at the Hirshhorn possible. I also want to acknowledge that we have in-kind support for the international tour of the exhibition from Japan Airlines. And here locally, we have the partnership of the Embassy of Japan. And I want to acknowledge Minister Kaitano, who is here with us, and to thank you again for your partnership in working with us and celebrating this important exhibition. I want to welcome some additional special guests, Atsuko Koyanagi from Koyanagi Gallery in Tokyo, who works and represents Hiroshi in Tokyo. And I also want to acknowledge Gen Aihara, who is Hiroshi's assistant and a wonderful artist who's been a great partner in all aspects of organizing this exhibition. I also want to acknowledge Michael Fried, who's here with us tonight as well. He is the Boone Professor for Humanities at Johns Hopkins University, and he's going to be lecturing here on March 21st at noon, talking about Hiroshi's work as well as his work in the context of contemporary photography. So please mark your calendars for that. I also want to finally thank the Stephen and Heather Mnuchin Foundation that makes our Meet the Artist series possible in an ongoing way. This is the third year that they've supported this series. And as one of the museums that's part of the Smithsonian Institution, we're very fortunate to receive an annual federal allocation that supports our ongoing operations. But our special programs and exhibitions like Meet the Artist and this exhibition is made possible through private support and through our annual donors. So we invite your involvement in the museum through membership in the museum's annual circle, and we'll have information as you leave the museum about joining if you're interested in getting more involved at the Hirshhorn and getting involved in special events. But right now it's time to meet the artist. So I'd like to welcome Hiroshi Sugimoto and Carrie Brower to the stage. Thank you.
First thing we'd like to discuss, because it will be seen over at the Sackler beginning on April 1st, is a new collection that Hiroshi has begun maybe 2 years now.
Right.
Is a fossil collection.
Mm-hmm.
These are some images of the dioramas.
Yes.
You see different ones from upstairs. But mm-hmm. maybe you could explain about the fossil collection and its relationship to the dioramas.
Yes. Well, I started buying fossils, the real fossils, started two years ago. So this is rather new. And the reason why I decided to start buying, collecting fossils is because of my own photography. And this photo was taken at the Carnegie Museum of Art. They have a natural history museum attached to the museum. So this supposedly 500 million years ago seen underwater when the first life started forming under the water. And it's called Cambrian period. And so let me show you Bornean period. This is 350 million years ago. It's hard to imagine 350 million years ago. And the Permian period, you know, this dinosaur period, this is 250 to 200 million years ago. So why not to buy the real thing? And this is also Cambrian period, 500 million years ago. And then it's a huge piece. It's like 2-3 meters long. And it's called the trilobite. And this seems like an ancestor of cockroach or something. But at the same time, this is an ancestor of our life as well, the
yes.
human being as well.
Yes.
So, and then I found interesting fact that the fossil works exactly same as photography. So this is a pre-photography time recording devices, which I named it. So, you know, this trilobite
so
was
fossil
living.
Fossil is now a dead word. It's a fossil itself. So it's a,
right.
What is it, pre-recording?
Pre-photography time recording devices.
Yes.
So the 500 million years ago, those creatures were living under the water. And all of a sudden, maybe underwater eruption of the volcano came, and all of a sudden just crashed to the ground, and it's been there for 500 million years. And then one of us, you know, and then this was underground once, but now it's came up to the ground. This is this was found in Morocco. So the archaeologist came and dig it and just opened it. And wow, this is an impression of the time of 500 million years ago. So this is a positive side. That's it. So I like to fooling people, but you know, this shows clearly that my tendency to how to record the time that's a concept.
Yes.
So from the very early stage, my interest was time-related project.
Yes, I mean, you know? I think, you know, in the seascapes, mm-hmm. In many ways, in the motion picture theaters in which
right.
you leave the shutter open for the entire duration of the mm-hmm. film, in the dioramas, the interest in time there, in
right.
the fossil collecting, there's so much to do with time and mm-hmm. memory in these works.
So this was an unmatured stage of time conscious.
Yeah, although you look pretty close to a conceptualist here.
Well, I show you, well, then this is, now I'm back, this is 1974 after graduation of my college at the Art Center College of Design. So I came to New York and I start wandering and I start shooting around New York City scenes with 35 millimeter camera, Nikon. It's not a large format 8x10 yet. And then I went to American Museum of Natural History and start, you know, shooting something like this. So this is, one of them. Then I get serious. Wow, this is something weird and something interesting is going on. Let's bring my serious 8x10 camera and then let's frame it without museum frame. Then it might be something look different. And then this is the first one that you see it upstairs. This is the first serious successful artwork.
Well, what was it that drew you to the Natural History Museum to begin with? I mean, you've mentioned that
right.
you kept winding up there.
Uh-huh.
And you've also mentioned that there were ways of looking mm-hmm. that occurred to you at the time in terms
right.
of a kind of one-eyed vision.
Right. Well, after spending 3 years, late 60s, early 70s, then I had problems having a hallucinogenic visions all the time. 3 years in California that time. So when I came to New York, you know, this is something strange, and this is something I always encounter, the vision of the reality. Sometimes, you know, I lose the feeling of solidness of the reality. You know, it's here and just a solid concrete building, but somehow it looks like unreal things. It's just so thin and just a paper thin, the projected image might be a reality for me. So this can be some kind of, it can be psychological disorder of some kind, but let's use this, my nature of seeing things can be projected onto my photographic vision so that I can call it as my art.
Yeah.
So, and this...
So the world to you mm-hmm. doesn't feel as real in some ways as...
To begin with, the solidness of the world as a vision. Maybe I had too much drug while I was in California, but... But I took it rather serious.
It seems like as many people understand.
Yeah, as my age of mid-50s and living in this country, you know, against Vietnam and Kent University, you know, and then, yes, so, well, even President Clinton took the marijuana. He inhaled here, right?
Inhale.
Up here, right? So that was the culture of that time in the 60s and 70s, and I really enjoyed, you know. But I rather took it serious, you know, just having some small LSD and you know, put it into my body, and it changed my vision for a couple of days. And then, you know, this is some kind of interesting philosophical study, how my thinking and vision can be changed with so little you know, presence of the material. So I was curious about my condition of mentality, you know. I thought it's very stable, you know, till I moved to California, but everything gets so suspicious. And I am very interested in psychology, so I just decided to use my body and brain to test it. How much you know material can affect my mind, and then it's just very you know the dosage is very important. So that was one of my study myself in California.
David, I think you and I totally missed it in the essay.
Well, I shouldn't say this, but well. So this the diorama looks so unreal to me, but yeah. It's at the same time it's real.
Yes, and you talked to me once about also mm-hmm. this notion that you had in New York that it occurred to you one day uh-huh. About covering one of your eyes.
Yes, right.
What was that about?
So when I was you know shooting visiting the American Museum of Natural History, and you know, I just cover my one eye, and then all of a sudden. It's a camera vision. Camera is one eye vision. And the humans or other mammals, you know, why we have two eyes, not just one eye? Because we have to measure the distance, the perspective, so that you measure you know, from the two different angles and you focus on this so that you can develop the sense how far this object is. So if you look at the diorama with two eyes, then you instantly measure the backdrops as only like 10 feet away. Mm-hmm. But when you close one eye, then you lose this sense of depth. Then it just looks like it's just continuously running into the field.
Yeah.
It introduces an idea, which mm-hmm. I don't know is true or not, but for mm-hmm. me, it works in thinking about your work, mm-hmm. which is this idea that somehow mm-hmm. All your work is about photography, but it's a mm-hmm. kind of photography that isn't about the history of photography. Mm-hmm. It's a photography that almost exists in your mind mm-hmm. and in your vision of the world, mm-hmm. perhaps even before photography was born.
Right.
You know, it was before mm-hmm. it was invented. Mm-hmm. And the things that you often pick out to mm-hmm. photograph strike me as often things that are precursors to photography. Mm-hmm. Whether you're collecting fossils or whether mm-hmm. it's a diorama that freezes time in some way, mm-hmm. Or a way of taking a movie theater, which is mm-hmm. a black box and it's like a camera obscuring mm-hmm. itself, letting mm-hmm. light in from some other world, which then you photograph because you're inside the camera.
Mm-hmm. So I feel more like not a photographer, but the painter who first start painting the vision onto the cave wall so that I can project my kind of inner vision onto some kind of surface. So that, this is usually photographer try to capture the image outside of himself or herself. But in my case, I'm just trying to project my own inner vision onto the screen of the reality. So this is the way I see. So it's, as long as I can see it the way I want to see it, then it must be able to be photographed the way I see things. So
the photograph is inside.
Photograph is here, let's project onto the reality.
Which is a completely different way of working than mm-hmm. many well-known 20th century photographers, mm-hmm. Had, which was like the street photographers who were shooting very quickly, very rapidly along the street, capturing mm-hmm. hundreds of images, and choosing one out mm-hmm. of a bunch. For you, it's there first, and then you figure out how to create it from
So I usually it's a single shot rifle. It's just one bullet and you shoot, get hit. Right. Yeah, Mr. Cheney is a different kind of gun.
I think the street photographers were more the scatter shot.
Right.
Single bullet.
Right. Single bullet.
But actually, and what's interesting is the slowness of your approach too. The uh-huh. way it takes a lot of time to set up these shots mm-hmm. and to think about them. And there's a page here which shows some of your thinking about them.
Right. So this was the. Yeah, record of my diorama shooting, and it says Hyena Jacobacha, which you see it upstairs. So I made a four exposure first from the fourth, f64 30 minutes for the first, and then two shot, and then 45 minutes and 20 minutes, and then processed with the developer D23 for 68 at the 68 degree, 60 minutes and 7 minutes. So it's very technical, but I'm very kind of scientific oriented in a way.
And well, without getting into it too deeply, it's interesting to me to see that you're using F64. Mm-hmm. You don't even try anything else. It's F64,
right.
F64. And so what you're doing is getting, I assume, mm-hmm. an incredibly
detailed and sharp.
Yeah.
I don't care how much longer it takes. 30 minutes sitting there, it's just boring. But that A must be F64 is the first condition. Yeah. So the famous F64 club member.
Right.
I'm the last one, probably. Here
mm-hmm. to answer that.
So. Right. Here we go on. So this is the final. Mm. And it's very dark there. I don't bring any of my lighting equipment. So this is actually existing light.
So there's no artificial light, just the light that was in the museum, or did you take the light out of the museum?
No, I used the existing light. So this is the way how the museum is lit. But this is so artificially lit, so there's a bunch of tungsten lights up there. And then the problem is the sky part gets so harsh and overexposed. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. sometimes I do, during the 30 minutes exposure, I just put the black t-shirts and black cap, everything black, so that even I show up in front of the lens, I will be invisible for the camera. And then having a board, black board, to cover the top part for 10-15 minutes so that I can balance the density on the bottom foreground and sky body.
So you're actually in these shots?
Yeah, it's in front of the grass and Japanese bunraku puppet theater. I shouldn't be visible, yes. And just controlling the light value to match the body of the photography.
Interesting. So well, that was one of the problems 19th century photographers
mm-hmm.
had.
Yeah, Gustave Le Gray. Usually the Gustave Le Gray is a famous seascapes mm-hmm. photographer. He used double negative.
Yeah.
So he shoot
a montage.
Yeah, sky first and then the water. And then they just put them together.
Yeah, otherwise the sky burns bright white.
Yeah. So mine is more sophisticated way. I don't fake it tough. So, yeah, these are the record of the diorama shooting. Oh.
I threw this in. Hiroshi didn't know this was going to happen, but I wanted you to see a picture of Hiroshi just as he was moving to New York.
Right, and, I was...
sort of in awe of what was going to come in your career. But actually, who you were in awe of was this woman.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, well, this is even older. I shot this when I was a junior high student, maybe 14 or 15 14. Years, 14. I was in love with Audrey Hepburn. And I wanted to get her photos. So I decided to go into the movie theater and then take her photos of the movie itself. So this is the first movie shot I did. And then I studied, and it's very difficult to make a movie image stop in a still photography. So I studied it, and it says, it's written in Japanese. But the 1/30th of the second makes the movie image stop. Other shutter speeds makes lying in between the images. So, and I process it by myself. So I was at 14 years old. I was already good established photographer, technically.
Well, what's sort of interesting about it is that it has a lot of your future work in it. In
yes.
a way, going into movie theaters, mm-hmm. Trying to
and
capture something on the screen,
right.
The portrait, mm-hmm. Idea, and the sense of time, too,
right.
That you're actually taking a film and something mm-hmm. that exists and in motion, you're reducing down to a still image.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I wanted to publish this, but the copyright problem, so this is the first time to be shown to the public without permission. And then this is never shown before, but this is the first test of my movie theater series. It's called St. Mark's Cinema in New York, 8th Street and 2nd Avenue. It's a wanderer theater. It's so filthy, lousy theater.
Filthy?
Yeah.
Theater.
Yes. It's, you know, when you walk, the wall, the floor is so sticky.
Remember the film that was playing?
No, I don't remember this one.
But you told me at one point that mm-hmm. For the theaters,
yeah.
That it wasn't a matter of just experimenting in the theater. I mean, it was that, but mm-hmm. It wasn't that you came upon this idea accidentally.
Right.
The vision.
Vision
of
came
a
first.
Bright screen.
Mm-hmm.
A bright white rectangle
yes.
came to you first.
Yes. So one night, you know. I got this vision. So again, it's probably kind of hallucinogenic vision. But I was thinking one night that what if I take a picture of the entire movie for 1.5 hours or 2 hours, then it must be this vision that the screen gets so overexposed, so it's almost like a light is burning out from the screen and lit the interior of the theater. So I just envisioned it. So next step is just go into the theater and let's test it and let's make it happen the way I envisioned it. Mm-hmm. And this is amazing. It's the first test. And I set my camera, I just sneak in basis. I can't explain to other people what I'm going to do. And it's an 8x10 camera, it's a big camera. So I cannot even sit in the center. I was so shy. And I set my camera, just sneak in, and then let's...
Took a test.
Took a test, wide open anyway.
And this was for the whole duration of the film?
Yes.
Yes.
When I processed it, and I got the negative. Yes, I amazed by myself. Wow, you're good. And then this is the second test. This theater still exists, I think, on the 21st or 2nd Street in 7th Avenue. No longer movie theater. But yes, so I just, so second test, it's confirmed that this will work.
Yeah.
So let's take it serious, and then this is the first one. I place my camera in the center, and I get the proper permission to do this from a movie theater chain called the United Artists. So the first time, this is the first serious successful shot. So the decoration of the theater wasn't my main interest.
Right.
But I was young and unknown, so I thought, well, let's make it something decorative a little bit. Oh, I remember this was a porno movie in the Queens. Basketball player, coach for the young girl school. I don't want to explain anymore.
You know, Hiroshi, I'm sorry. We have to move on because we can't show those kind of things.
I see. So this is the one upstairs. I remember this year, this movie was back in 1977 or 78, and then Saturday Night Fever.
Saturday Night Fever.
Yes. John Travolta.
So here we have Saturday Night Fever, the entire film.
Yes.
But in one image.
Yes. One image. One yes. Image. Right. Mm-hmm. So. And then this is, well, this is the driving theater. Well, then moving to seascapes, right?
Yeah, these were interesting because I had never really seen these before. The first time I saw one of these photographs really mm-hmm. was in your History of History show.
Right.
And I think we have the one that's in the show coming up here. But mm-hmm. in a way, they were a bit of a precursor for the seascapes.
Right. Again, and I was thinking of how to visualize the water images before I get to this concept of seascape series. So I went back to Japan in 1977 to get the, I was permitted to get the green card. So I have to go to the American embassy in Tokyo to receive it. So I spent about a few months in Japan, and then I start traveling, photographing waterfall in Japan. Mm. And it's one of them. This is the second one. This is a famous Kegon waterfall, which is a part, the part of the History of History show. Mm-hmm. You will see it in Washington, April 1st, yes. At the Fria Sakura.
But you were experimenting right. with exposures and with mm-hmm. How long to keep the
right.
the shutter open.
Mm-hmm. But this is more like a straightforward photography. But the nature worship of Japan is, you know, this is very interesting to me. So I kind of get spiritualized from the waterfall series to traveling around. And then it gave me a kind of idea, well, let's go into more abstract design. And then, well, it gave me an idea to move into the seascapes like this.
Yes.
The sharp horizon line in the center, and air and water, and that's it.
Yeah. I mean, what's, I think, wonderful about these photographs mm-hmm. is that they go against what most mm-hmm. photographs of the ocean
right.
tend to do. I mean, mm-hmm. most of them are shot on the beach, usually mm-hmm. with some beach right. hand, or mm-hmm. a painting with a sailboat. These mm-hmm. are very starkly minimalist.
Right.
But they seem to do something. You mentioned, actually, in your reminiscences as a child, that mm-hmm. you used to take a train along the coast,
right.
and you looked down from the coast mm-hmm. at the ocean, mm-hmm. and there was this idea that mm-hmm. almost nothing in the world had actually mm-hmm. you know, remained the same as it mm-hmm. was millions of years ago,
right.
except perhaps the view mm-hmm. of the ocean from this right. perspective. Mm-hmm. And you shoot these from above, rather than standing on the shore, down on the earth. And each one of them is constructed in the same way, simply
same
dividing it in
yes.
half with the sky and the water, or simple elements. I think like that
this
shows
is
how you do it.
Yeah, many people ask whether I was on the boat or shooting from the airplane, but this is the typical sight I usually shoot. It's just kind of dangerous.
Yeah.
Yes.
it's a good thing we didn't lose you a long time ago.
This is the sea coast from Italy to the Greece, so one of the Mediterranean. And I like Italy because the food is very good on the sea coast.
But then you made this decision not to photograph the same ocean over and over,
yeah.
but different oceans around the world.
Right.
And yet always with the same composition.
Same composition. And it's amazingly, it's different from location to location. And I found it's very interesting because it's the same seascapes. But according to the different peoples living for a long time, and it's culture-wise, language, the same water and air, the people named differently. So Yellow Sea from China and Red Sea from Egypt, and then also Black Sea. Why it's called Black Sea? I'm very curious. So I picked the name, interesting name first, and then go there, and then photograph it. So I just, very interesting of the early stage of people naming things like very simple matter. Water itself, or seascapes. So this is like a tracing back to the ancient time when the human beings start gaining consciousness, which means the development of the language and words. So how people name the things, in what sequence. I think it's related to this is my relation to my childhood consciousness. When I first saw this seascapes, this is one of my oldest memory that I remember this seeing it, and it gave me very strong impression. And then since that moment, I realized that I'm here, living in this world. I'm a human being. I am thinking. I'm conscious about this world. So it may trace back not only my childhood memory, but it may trace back to the entire human consciousness memory. Before, I don't know, before that, it's just we all evolved from that under the water creatures. And then suddenly, yes.
First
image.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so in a way, it's time travel in
yes.
some sense. I mean, in these photographs of the ocean, you're actually exploring the notion that photography doesn't necessarily just have to capture the here and now, but if you do it right, you can also kind of capture the sense of before mankind was even around, before the sea was named the sea,
right.
or the oceans were named ocean. People don't figure, have a big role in most of your photographs, actually.
Yes.
At least living people.
So I want people to wander around and leave, kind of start wondering what this guy is doing. The seascapes is so simple, so you can project, the viewer can project your own imagination onto the seascapes, so people it recall the personal memories of self, I think.
This is for your night seascapes?
This is the night seascapes. Every time I study the location and geographic location and the phase of the moon and planet and sun, so that I can, and the right side is the sketches, where I'm supposed to be, and then the moon, particular day of the year and months, and I should be facing east, and the moon comes up in certain direction with half moon or full moon, so that I can get the reflection designed onto the surface of the sea. And so it's kind of complicated. This is even my sketch, and the earth, and I'm standing on this point, and then what moon's supposed to be here on a certain time. So it's very well pre-calculated. It's not just by accident. Usually photography is accident, but
yes.
mine is not non-accident.
Right.
This is different
yeah.
scene,
well, now
right?
We now enter into other territory.
Right.
Some of you may not know, but actually Hiroshi spent quite a number of years as a Japanese antiquities dealer in New York City, and was actually very successful at this.
Ah, yes. I've known Jim Urach at FLIR for a long time before he became director of the museum. I was totally in a different business. So.
And at one point, I remember you said there was a moment in your life, actually, you had to make a choice between being a gallerist and actually, or selling his works, and choosing to be a photographer.
Right.
But I'm curious, you'll see some of these in the History of History show, but it would be interesting to hear a little bit about how you got into this, and also how this has influenced your photography.
Right, yes. Well, this, by the way, this is the portrait of Prince Shotoku, and it's a sculpture, small sculpture about this big, and made in the 13th century, Kamakura period. One of the first serious museum quality piece I bought, and then sold it to Princeton Museum, Princeton Art Museum. And it's a long story, make it short. You know, I was a starving artist, and then I married to a Japanese girl, and then we had a baby, and then we have a financial problem. So my wife started a small antique shop in Soho, and then I started helping her. And then I went back to Japan and started buying antiques. I had no education, no art history, Japanese art history education. But as I do it, I get so heavily involved, you know, things I like, I want to buy. And within 5 years, I became the one of the top museum dealer, because I was in a very good position. I was only Japanese art dealer living in this country and dealing in Japanese art. So I can pretend that I'm a genuine Japanese art dealer. But at the same time, I can quickly, you know, studied, and then I loved it. And then I found it's just some kind of influence onto my art. You know, I'm just buying things, rather expensive things for the museum, and just living together with it. Then I can just feel it very strongly, the craftsmanship, and then spiritual quality, level of the spiritual quality. These are not made as a commercial object. You know, it's just kind of religious object, but. Sleeping, living together, then I can inhale the spirits of the quality. So, I appreciate so much about the quality level of 12th, 13th century Japanese art. So I decided to compete with my standard of the art, matching to the quality that I like, which is not the contemporary art field of now, but 12th, 13th century quality of the art. I show you some of my former collection. And then I even published the first photography book is my antique dealer catalog. So not even a photography book. This is also 12th century beautiful flying Amida. And then went to a Jackson Bach collection, Mary and Jackson Bach collection in New York. This I still have it, so this will be shown as a part of the history show. This is also 12th century Shinto deity, and it's a very simplified but yet so strong. And this is a tantric Buddhism Vajra. It's one is 12th century, one is 13th century. It was sold to a Metropolitan Museum. So as I practice this dealership, I start learning how to read a curator's mentality, or thinking. It's rather difficult, but it's once you get trained, it's so easy. So finally, Met was one of my major clients, and after dealing like 10 years, and they gave me a show as a one-man show, not as a dealer, but the artist. So without Met, I couldn't be survived. And then back to my art.
Well, we put these in because one of the things that I wanted to sort of bring up is that right from the start, I think your approach to photography was not just to make individual photographs.
Right.
I mean, yes, it is that, of course, to some degree, but it wasn't just to make individual photographs, but it was to make installations.
Right.
And so the environment, the architecture, the sequence of the work, the way it's laid out, has always been extremely important for you. And actually, so we thought we would share a few different... this is the Carnegie.
Carnegie, 1991. The first time I made outside waterproofed seascapes, placed within a cascade. And then it's a show run from October through next spring. So during the winter time, it's became one chunk of block of ice frozen inside.
Wonderful.
It's
Bordeaux?
Bordeaux, CAPC Bordeaux. So it's been traveling around the world.
And what's interesting is the way you hang the pieces outdoors.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember one of the times we talked about your seascapes originally was that you had no fear at all about these fading.
Fading, yes. All. I want them to be faded. And then just sometimes it's disappear. Then this is it may remain some kind of traces of time past, so that photography, it's very visible, but it's just traces of time. That's what I wanted to get.
Yeah.
But so far, the group of those photos been traveling around the world almost 10 years. And so far, nothing changed, unfortunately.
If our conservators are here tonight, I'd this is a very beautiful show.
Oh, yes. Who curated this show?
This was a show, Hiroshi, and I did at MoCA back in 1993.
Right.
And, even then, it was very clear. It was just a small seascape show that we did. And one room
was day
seascapes, and the next room over was the night seascapes.
Night one is good. This is Hara Museum Arc, not the one in Tokyo, but outside of Tokyo. And it's designed by Isozaki. It's a beautiful museum. Yeah.
Yes. Same as MoCA, Isozaki.
Ah, yes, right. This is Sainsbury Center, Norwich, England. It's the Buddha.
These are the Buddhas.
Right.
And I have a feeling that, you know, a number of the people in the audience, if they've seen the exhibition, might be fascinated to know a little more about the Buddha series and how it was shot in Kyoto,
right.
What it is, the shrine, and and your reason for actually installing it the way you
together,
did.
Right? Well, this is the way it used to be shown, but now from Mori Museum here at the Hirschhorn, I decided to put them all together. And it's very spectacular, and I think it's working fine. Many people may have visited this famous temple called Sanjo Sangen no in Kyoto. This building was built in the 12th century with 1,000 statues, kanon, they're almost human size. So this is more like a Watered Maria's Broken Kilometer, like, you know, conceptual art of the 12th century. And then once it was burned down in the 13th century, so it's been standing there for almost 700 years. And I envisioned the concept of this art. Actually, the architect designed this building with 1,000 kanon figures facing east, so that when the sun comes up, it's hit the shoji screen in front of 1,000 figure, and then only for 1 hour, it's just the gold leaves shine out from the temple, and it's spectacular. It's so gorgeous. And then only 1 hour, but the temple opens to the public from 9. And even the monk, the Buddhist priest, they don't come to this particular moment. And then I just guessed and imagined this should be the conceptual, very important concept of this building. Why don't I photograph it and let them show it?
I understand it took a long time.
Yeah, because the priests, they have no interest at all. I cannot explain how important this moment is. The priests, from the 12th century, the people used to be do some ceremony on this particular moment that the tradition completely forgotten. Mm-hmm. Yes. So it took 7 years for me to get the permission. And then they are very snobbish people. And when I had the chance to do a show at the Met, that's the first time. So what I saw, well, this is a good chance to ask them again to get the permission. So I asked Philippe de Montebello, museum director, to write a very nice letter. This is the artist, Hiroshi Sugimoto, and then we are planning to have his show, one-man show. Please let him give him a permission to photograph your temple. The answer was no, really. Yes. All the American people, they come and see us. We don't go out to show us. Ah. That's the answer. Uh-huh. How can I say?
Wow. How did you finally get permission?
Then I asked again to write a nice letter to government, cultural minister, Japan, from Philippe de Montebello. And then I asked cultural minister to ask temples. And then they finally said, because they are receiving almost like $200,000, $300,000 every year to restore the temple. So they cannot say no to the government. So with this letter, they said, well, this is a request from the cultural minister. This time, we don't say no. They never say yes.
They never said yes. And this is an outdoor work.
Right, this is the appel. It's Amsterdam. Yes. And this is Guggenheim Museum show downtown. And then I did, we are not showing this, but this is Last Supper.
Yes. So this is where you introduced, or one of the first introductions of the large portraits.
Right.
Yes. Which came out of your a series of smaller wax. Mm-hmm. Wax figures out of Madame Tussauds and Moulin right. Wax Museum and places mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And so this is where people actually have come into your photographs mm-hmm. in a way. Only, again, not living people, but tableaux, tableaux vivants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This was the last show of that Guggenheim downtown Soho. Also, Isozaki designed this space.
Aha.
Yes.
And I understand they didn't have any money, so your sign stayed up after it closed for
for
year.
2 years.
2 years.
Yes. And a Prada shop opened downstairs. Yeah. So without no Prada shop name, so people get confused and step into Prada shop and think this is my shop.
Your exhibition. Well, there's still time to become a fashion designer. And we wanted to put this in because at the Mori Museum, we actually had the space there to include in the exhibition something that Hiroshi had designed, I guess, for Dia originally.
Yes, well, we have.
And we included it at the Mori Museum. It's very beautiful. And I think this is actually a shot from Bregenz.
Right.
And it includes the pine trees, which are traditional
backdrops for the
No Theater performance. Mm-hmm. But it's a stage designed by Hiroshi.
Right. So this, again, this is more like a solid-wit-like No Stage. And then this is actually the Dear Art performance with no play. Yes. It's everything is lit by candlelight. So I'm just recreating a medieval 15th century quality of the Japanese theater in this case.
I know there's a book that influenced you a great deal in Praise of Shadows.
I'm praised by Tanizaki.
Yes. Mm. This is probably a good one to perhaps end on in a way, because I'd like to open it up to the audience too. But we'd like to show you this work, which we obviously can't bring into the museum. This is a Shinto shrine, which Hiroshi renovated, pretty much rebuilt, that's on the island of Naoshima, off Japan.
The first architectural commission as an artist or as an architect. So in this case, not so much photographic aspect get involved, but there's some little, yes.
Well, the interesting thing, at least for me, is that the steps that lead up to the shrine have been made out of the same glass that camera lenses are ground from. So this means that the light pours down the mm-hmm. steps.
Yes, beautiful.
From the shrine.
It's crystal clear.
And enters mm-hmm. underground into a chamber that's underground, mm-hmm. A dark chamber.
Yes, so the only light can travel through this underground chamber.
No, people cannot.
Right? People cannot. But there's a passageway to get into this underground chamber. This is a passage for human to get in, so this is just the entrance of the underground chamber.
To me, it strikes me very much that what uh-huh. you had in mind here was creating a kind of link between a sort of spirituality, mm-hmm. between the Buddhas in mm-hmm. a way, and photography. Right. I mean, it's a giant camera in many ways.
So this is underground dark chamber, which works almost similar to the camera, because mm-hmm. I'm using this optical quality glass and let the lights in.
Yeah, and in a similar mm-hmm. way to the movie theaters, receiving this light from mm-hmm. a kind of fictive world,
yes.
You're receiving this sort of spiritual light down mm-hmm. from the shrine into mm-hmm. the dark chamber right. below.
And then as people walk out through this concrete small passage, then what people encounter is the actual seascapes, not the photographic vision this case. Yeah, it's exactly the same.
Thing.
It's a real thing.
Very yeah. beautiful. Mm-hmm. I think, Hiroshi, what I'd like to do is go uh-huh. to this photo to end the discussion
uh-huh.
and talk about this. This is right. The blind photographer.
A portrait of blind photographer.
Portrait
this
of
is,
blind photographer.
This is what I titled it, the most recent self-portrait.
And the guy looks familiar to me. It's a self-portrait. Mm-hmm. And in some way, I think this sort of sums everything up
uh-huh.
in some way, because I think your work is probably more about mm-hmm. your own inner vision
right.
of the world mm-hmm. than it is studying the external vision
right.
that's actually out there. Mm-hmm. And so the blind photographer seems a
right.
perfect metaphor for mm-hmm. for your work.
Right. So I'm almost not looking at the outside world. I'm just looking into my inner world. So in that sense, I'm blinded in a way. But I want to project my inner vision onto the outside world. So I'm wearing this thick glass. So it's almost the vision is blear and unclear, and it's almost invisible visions. I'm just try to project myself onto the outside world.
Well, thank you for talking about your work.
Thank you.